Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two episodes in conversation with the celebrated American poet, Tony Barnstone, this week with his brother, Robert. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Tony Barnstone is the prolific creator of varied output who has won many awards and honors. He has published more than 20 books of poetry, and he is also a literary translator and essayist. His Tongue of War, From Pearl Harbor to Nagasaki, 2009, is a book of dramatic monologues set in the Pacific during World War II, based on interviewing military veterans. It was the basis for a CD of songs, Tokyo Burning, World War II songs. For another of his books of verse, Pulp Sonnets, Tony Barnstone drew on classic pulp fiction, gothic literature, B-movies, and comic books. With illustrations by Iranian artist Amin Mansouri, it is a sort of graphic novel in verse. Barnstone has also published books of translations of Chinese poems and of ghazals by Ghalib, the acclaimed 19th-century mystical Urdu-language poet of the Mughal Empire. He has also published a set of richly illustrated tarot cards, the Radiant Tarot, designed to spark creativity. Raised in Indiana, Tony Barnstone comes from a family of poets, as we'll hear. He earned a PhD at the University of California at Berkeley under poets Robert Pinsky and Robert Haas, and is now a professor of English at Whittier College in California. We interviewed him when he and his Sydney-based brother, Robert Barnstone, an architect, were in Canberra in November for the annual conference of the Australasian Association of Writing Programs. My colleague, Peter Monahan, noted that Tony Barnstone is something of a poetry cottage industry.
You have a tarot deck that's poetry-related and that's going on an international tour. You have a book of poems that use the voices of participants in the bombing of Hiroshima.
Actually, the whole World War II in the Pacific, so from Pearl Harbor to Nagasaki.
And that was adapted into a musical CD with two singers.
Called Tokyo's Burning, World War II Songs. Available on Amazon.com, Spotify, and other YouTube, all for free for whoever wants it.
You have a graphic novel in poetry, which is a feminist werewolf tale. Your whole life seems dedicated to poetry, and it seems to come from all over the place.
I'm very interested in the idea of the total artist, although I only dabble as a painter and I write songs and don't play music. I really love collaborating with others. I remember William Blake, who not only was a great painter and printmaker, but also was a fantastic poet, also wrote original music and put his songs to music. So he was a total artist. In the same way, the artist, poet, musician of the Tang Dynasty would have all those skills, kind of like the idea of the Renaissance man or the polyvocal woman. For me, this is a kind of exciting way to live my life. And so I'm writing an opera now with a collaboration. I've done the tarot deck. I've done the music CD. I've collaborated with an Iranian artist for this book, Pulp Sonnets, where it's sort of, as you say, a graphic novel about pulp fiction. And I'm interested in that because it pushes me a little bit. I like to stretch myself a little bit. Now, interestingly enough, this is something a lot of my family members do as well. My sister's an artist and a poet. My father does paintings and drawings and poetry. My brother's a sculptor and architect, and he often adapts literature into his work.
Tony Barnstone's family. It is quite a poetic clan. As he just mentioned, his sister, Aliki Barnstone, is a poet, translator, including of the collected poetry of C.F. Kavafi, memoirist and author or editor of many critical works about Emily Dickinson, spiritual poetry around the world, and much else, and a visual artist as well. She has published 8 books of poetry, including Dwelling, Sheep Meadow, 2016. She published her first book of poetry, The Real Tin Flower, at the age of 12 with Macmillan, with a foreword by Anne Sexton. She is professor of English and creative writing at the University of Missouri and was the poet laureate of the U.S. state of Missouri from 2016 to 2019. Aliki and Tony's mother, Anne Roberts, is the artist Elie Zalapalu Barnstone, and their father is Willis Barnstone. He is a renowned poet, scholar of spiritual texts, and translator of them, as well as of numerous poets from many countries and eras. His list of accomplishments and letters is, in fact, almost impossibly long. In a moment, we'll hear from Tony's brother, Robert Barnstone, an architect, about his architect forebears in the Barnstone clan and about how he incorporates poetry in his sculptural work.
You come from a family of poets and creative people, very active ones. Your brother's Robert, and Robert's here with us. Robert, what are you here to talk about at this conference, and how do you see your relation as an architect and sculptor to the rest of the family, I guess?
Well, I also kind of come by being an architect, honestly, because my uncle Howard was an architect, and he designed the house we lived in. He was the first practice I worked for, and so forth. And we just finished a book on Howard. Howard worked with Philip Johnson, did the Rothko Chapel, and things like that. Did amazing things. A 5-time gold medal award winner, and you know, really amazing architect, but also psychologically damaged, as most of us are in general, I guess. Mm-hmm. But anyway, to answer your question, years ago, I started to become interested in ideas about architecture that are at the boundaries of architecture. And to get out of a terrible postmodern period in the 70s and 80s, we really looked towards theory and art to get ourselves out of what was really a pretty horrible time for architecture. Mm-hmm. And to give it substance and meaning after it became animated, ultimately. One of the things that I became interested in is this notion of the space of the imagination. Because the architect imagines things, you imagine everything, and then you make the contracts and you do everything, and it's built. And if it is built properly, it's built as your imagination had placed it in the world. And so one could say that it's purely a conceptual art, but resonant if it comes out to be real. And one could argue a similar thing towards literature and poetry, that it is a conceptual art. And then once someone actually reads it, then it actually takes on action and becomes interesting. So I submitted a proposal to a sculpture park competition, and the idea was to do 8 poems by my sister Aliki, 8 poems by my father Willis, and 8 poems by Tony. So there are 24 poems spread across about 2 kilometers in Providence, Rhode Island, and you walk along the river, and there are 24 poems along the river. And you walk up to these beautiful cedar lecterns, which are done in different kinds of framing techniques with stainless steel, black etched poems on them. And they're sort of bent into sculptural forms, very like a series of roofs, one might say, for the lecterns. And you can read the poems. And what's interesting is that when you do, the landscape itself begins to take on a different quality, because all of a sudden this part of the city now has a book which has been published across the landscape, and that book resonates with that landscape. And when I took the piece down, it was amazing. People came up to me and they're like, I walk through this park every single day and I read a poem a day, and at the end of the month I start again, and it's the most wonderful thing. And I think the installation was there for 2 years, so it was people got used to it being there. So this kind of idea came out of these notions of monuments. You know, what is a monument, and how do we, you know, regard the people when we see a monument and so forth. And so this is a different kind of thing where you enter this lectern, all of a sudden you read about this thing. Your imagination is taken into various histories, taken into a completely different place. You are, in a sense, completely detached, as you are when you're reading. You're outside of the body on some level and yet physically standing there. And then all of a sudden you snap back when the poem is done and you look around at your work and you're kind of like, shall I do that again? Right? You know? Anyway, so that is the basic idea behind the work, is to create a literary shroud over an urban area and to do a publication, that it's actually a public sort of thing. So in the same sense that a broadsheet might be, and different things. But I was never so interested in the absurd or the tedium of the absurdity as so many, you know, street literary people are. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, single sentences, you know, you are great or whatever, and just find that stuff stupid.
What do you intend it to do to those? Well, they're not really natural settings. A park is a sort of a man-made thing, but it's an urban creation of its own kind.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea really is that people will see the place very differently once they've experienced the poems. Mm. And I think that's a really interesting idea. Yeah. And in the same sense that you walk into a museum and you take in the context of the museum, and then every time you see the museum, you see the, not the museum, but the context of the museum. And the same thing happens to any kind of urban area. So all of a sudden, these poems start to become the context of the area, which I think is really, really interesting.
Do you intend a similar dynamic, Tony, when you create these sort of hybrid works? Mm. Is it to extend, I guess, the sort of resonance of the poetry, or what is it?
A simple answer to that question is I always have a free verse book going of poems I write sort of when the inspiration hits, and a project book going. And the project books often involve the documentary method, whether it's the Pulp Fiction, Pulp Sonnets book, or the World War II book called Tongue of War. And the idea there is to, yes, is to expand the possibilities of poetry in a certain sense. Because fiction writers, for example, aren't locked into the idea of merely writing in the first person about only themselves. Maybe they're more stuck in that way than they were in the past, but the idea that you could, you know, most novels you have multiple characters and setting, and you can fictionalize, you can make stuff up. But poets, especially after The Confessionals and The Beats and the Black Mountain Poets and all the movements of the 70s and 80s that centered the I, made the space between the poet and the narrator collapse. So I became interested in the idea that you can create characters, you can invent characters, or you can do the same thing that they do in historical fiction, the sort of thing that Kimberly's doing in her poems, with her poems about the women of the migration across the states in the 19th century and earlier. For me, I was very interested in going into, interviewing veterans and their families from the World War II while they were still alive, looking at diaries and letters and memoirs and oral histories, and adapting that into poetry and voices that so I could maybe escape the tyranny of the self and let the poem do the same thing that fiction can do and invent a whole world.
It's post-confessional, yes. Your approach.
It is, although interestingly enough, I also feel that it uses the techniques of confession, which is to say that it centers the I in that, maybe not always in Pulp Sonnets, but certainly in the World War II book, Tongue of War, the poems are first person. They're dramatic monologues. And so they're documentary poems that take the past and tell it not from the god's eye view, not from the historian's view, but from the worm's eye view, from the soldier in the muck, you know, ducking bullets and looking at the picture of his wife and child in his helmet and dreaming of home. That's the worm's eye view of the war versus, you know, the historians talking about the fall of Saipan. So that creates, I think, a different approach to things. It makes the poem history present tense. It saves us from presentism by making the voices of this past speak in our ears. And so in order to do that right, I had to do the right kind of research, which is to say, to really listen to the voices and the concerns of the people I was dealing with, and which is to say, if they were not pleasant people, they would speak in not pleasant ways in the poems. If they were speaking in the slang of the 1940s, I would use that slang because it was their authentic slang. Their concerns were my concerns. And the idea is that that kind of philosophical perspectivism of Ortega y Gasset or Nietzsche, where you try to determine what the what reality is from collating multiple perspectives. I can't tell you what the war meant, but all these voices can talk about it, and you can find your own path by looking at these polyvocal, multi visual ways of looking at the same object.
In that way, it is similar to what you did, Kimberly, with your work. And it brings to life also people who really are forgotten, but who probably were neglected in the first place.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about everything everyone's saying, and I'm thinking about how, you know, what I love what you said, Robert, and what you're saying, Tony, is there such a relationship for me between space in terms of just how areas are filled in poetry, right? How does a poem fill a page? How does it fill ourselves? Mm-hmm. You're talking about embodied poetry, really, right? When it's out in the world and you're walking through and experiencing it. So I think that it's that kind of energy then that allows one to compress time or remove it even, right? To take a historical subject and bring it right to the present moment, present concerns, contemporary readers, contemporary writers, but somehow deliver it with such authenticity then that you can look back again.
Yeah, as I see it, the dramatic monologue that brings history back to life is a way of embodying the moment of history in your body as you perform it. So the poem emerges on a column of air through your esophagus up to your through your throat up to your mouth. It's played by the tongue and the lips like a musical instrument, and it comes out into the world. You're literally performing it like you're a musician or a sax player, and making it in your body becomes the musical instrument. So here is it's also a bit like being an actor or something like that. So when I read the poems, I try to kind of really be the person. Here's at the retirement home, and this was after Abu Ghraib, and it's a World War II vet thinking about that at the retirement home.
A note about the context of this poem, it refers to events during the U.S. invasion of Iraq, where U.S. forces in the early 2000s infamously tortured and otherwise abused captives on U.S. and occupied soil.
I've had both knees replaced. I got a steel pin in my hip. I don't hear you so good, but I'm not stupid, son. How would you feel surviving the Bataan death march? No food for days, no water, and the ones who fell behind were bayoneted where they lay. And now you're marching off to death. Real hell is not old age, though, no. Taking away the rights we died for, saying torture's right, that's hell. Hand me the iron in those shirts, would you? Thanks, son. As long as I have fight, I'll love this country till it hurts. And it does. This is worse than what I saw overseas. Torture in America.
I've been working on poems that are very narrative. The new manuscript is, first off, it's very political, but the two poems I was thinking about reading are not in the political era that was, the poems that were written during the political era of the Trump years, but rather they're memories of things that I recall from my childhood in Indiana. And the first one is about the childhood bully. I had a particularly bad childhood bully, and it was called Bad Hand. Bad Hand. The yellow mouth of the school bus opened to eat him, and he slumped into the fractured plastic of his seat, knowing at the next stop, the boy with the fingers chopped off at the knuckles would climb into the bus like a panther among squirrels, take the seat behind him, and grind the whitened stumps into the back of his head while he flinched. What combination of starry omens and planetary dread, of boxcars and snake eyes, could have spun the world inside this child's heart to such daily vicious thrill at the despair of other children, the one with perfect hands. At lunch, huddled with friends by the mahogany-stained fold-up bleachers in the gym, he tried to ask them, but they studied dented apples and plastic rat sandwiches in wincing silence. In their minds, the awful hand was reaching over the ruptured and taped upholstery again and scraping like a bone bow across their resisting bodies, grating out the thin music of their screams, these beautiful little boys and girls who flinched away from the stumps of his loss. They also had suffered the knuckle torture, also had avoided the bus home, preferring to stumble through the cut black stubble of the cornfields and be late for dinner. But they could say nothing. He was a fact of life, like brain-eating bacteria. So the boy came up with his own scenarios for what violence had severed that hand. A bad cut on his table saw that spritzed the sawdust red. Freak guillotining by falling glass. Psycho stepfather with a hatchet. And often he wondered, what did they do with the severed digits? Did they keep them, strangely preserved in formaldehyde, floating and pointing everywhere and nowhere in the green liquid of a screw-top jar? Or did they bury them in a small box out in a field somewhere, or in the backyard by the oak tree, like a time capsule floating in earth through decades in which that sad and terrible boy was fated to be the asshole of every story? A tiny coffin in a makeshift graveyard where those fingers wait for the rest of him to join them, those pallid fetuses, those curling orchids, those question marks, the pale nails growing into hooks. So that's a narrative poem, kind of intense, I know. Sometimes I like to change the gender of the speaker so it's not always autobiographical. This actually literally happened to me, but I invented a character named Andrea for it to happen to you. This is Rec Room, and spelled W-R-E-C-K. Rec Room in America is recreation room, right? Andrea's tenuous body is a hanger for bell-bottom jeans and a plaid shirt with one tail dangling. She doesn't tuck in the loose tail or comb her long, lank hair. Her head is filled with hippie ideals learned from pop songs that assure her she is stardust, that she should let her freak flag fly, that all she needs is love, and that she should love the one she's with. But she's so shy that her leg is always skidding around under the table, and her voice cracks and stutters when speaking to boys and teachers. So when Duke and Rick ask her to come over after school, she says sure, even though it was Duke who shoved her back one recess so that she stepped right through her cello's golden belly, where she'd laid it on the grass like an angel in a body bag. Duke lives in a flaked and buckled brown row house 3 blocks from school. They trek through the lion grass of the neighbor's lawn and slide open the glass door below the balcony in the back into what Duke calls the rec room. Concrete floor, torn red bench press and set of iron weights, chipped green ping pong table, dartboard with black feathered darts, hunting rifle on a wooden rack on the far wall, patched leather couch facing a small boxy color TV propped up on a wood moving crate. Duke cracks the mini fridge in the corner and pulls out a can of Schlitz. He punches Andrea in the arm, peacocking a bit and grinning happily. My dad says, beer is God's apology for creating cancer. But when Rick bends over to get himself one, Duke's smile tightens. He grabs Rick by the belt at the back of his jeans and lifts him in the air, arms and legs and ratty blonde hair dangling like a heavy metal spider. Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you! Ha 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 ha! Duke shoves a hand into the crack between the cushions and pulls out something from within, like a doctor pulling out a baby's head. He slips it into the VCR, and the television crackles to life, moaning and sighing. Duke plops on the couch, kicks feet up on a stool, and winks at Andrea, who stands shyly against a wall, peeking at the blue screen where bodies are coiling around each other like the supple, strange tentacles of a giant octopus. But Rick looks bored. He sits on the red bench and bends into a few curls. He tosses a dart and misses, hitting the pockmarked millwork paneling. He lifts the rifle off the rack, slips a finger around the trigger, and aims it at Andrea's head. Andrea is saying, hey, hey, but Rick is laughing. Andrea walks left, right. She lopes through the door into the hallway, past 2 bedrooms dark as burial chambers, and back into the rec room again. But Rick runs after, keeping the rifle pointed at her head, all the parts of it, action, trigger, butt and hammer, lock, stock and barrel, the black mouth of the muzzle whispering, death. The television groans in pleasure. Duke is smiling with a hand inside his jeans. Rick is laughing grimly as Andrea runs through the house,
The chalky skin of the drywall, fogged low windows like congealed white eyes, veins and arteries of the hallways, the panting heart of the television, the beast fur carpeting, and a voice somewhere screaming, "Oh!"
We asked Tony Barnstone to read his poem, Moving Day.
Here's a poem about a woman who's leaving, and she's already not there.
Yeah.
She's already not in this poem even. It's just her belongings that you're moving out.
Yeah.
It's quite sad, by the way.
So this is a sonnet. It's from a book of sonnets, a kind of a novel in verse called Sad Jazz. And it's about a couple who fall in love. They get married. Get trouble into the marriage, they get divorced, they separate, and they go through the stages of recovery. And so it kind of follows them sonnet by sonnet. This is called Moving Day. It's late in the book. He piles her boxes in the courtyard under a tarp, the bookshelves, microwave, spare phone. And though his friends make clear, they wonder why he would help her move, he says, "It's fine. I want to save her money, help her out." And he does, helps her move out, feeling weight tear at his muscles. Now he is without her things. They are inside the truck, her freight, then on the freeway, then in her new flat, then gone. He's glad to ache in shoulder blades and arms. It means that though she's left him flat, left him behind like old footprints, he's made a choice as well to move her, remove her, a choice to move past, not be moved by her.
Before we end these two episodes with Tony Barnstone, let's listen again to one of the other poems he recited last week.
This is called Lamp or Mirror, and it was one of the sonnets I wrote inspired by Jorge Luis Borges, who has some really exciting, interesting ideas about the phenomenology of the mind and of perception in his poetry. Lamp or Mirror is kind of a classic study of Western literature that is rooted on the question of whether the mind is a mirror to the world or the mind is a lamp projecting on the world. If we're a mirror to the world, then coming from a rationalist perspective, whatever's inside should represent whatever's outside, and that's sanity, right? For Freud, that's the reality principle. But if you're a lamp, that means whatever's on the inside is being projected out onto the world, so that your eyes are almost like a movie projector, playing your meanings across nature. Right, so do you read the book of nature and find God in it, as you know Milton says you can do? Or do you project your idea of God onto nature when a nature, in fact, is just red in tooth and claw? So that this is called Lamp or Mirror. And it's a bit about that question of whether your dreams are real, whether the mind is a dream, whether the world is a dream, and what happens if we wake. When strange light stirs the mirror, forces swirl the shadows by the bathtub, and I glimpse a figure standing, glowing. As I rinse the toothpaste down the drain, his blind eye whirls numinous white. His hair is moonlight streaming. I know neurologists have shown the course of dreaming as synaptic lines of force. And even in this dream, I know I'm dreaming. Yet, when the light refracts at such an angle, it shows his broken face, frost in his beard, his black lips mouthing words I only hear as moaning of an operatic angel. His ice hand reaches out. I flinch in fear. The mirror breaks. I gasp awake. He's here.
Our guest these past two episodes has been visiting U.S. poet Tony Barnstone, along with his brother, architect and sculptor Robert Barnstone. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Torture in America.
Find out how you can become a part of the ArtSound community. Call us on 6295 7444 or online at artsound.fm.